My name is John Tran. This is the first time I've been on officially. I've been here since Sunday noon. I'm pastor of the Community of Christ, which is an ecumenical fellowship in Washington, D.C. And I have three lectures today, Friday, and Saturday, and they are interrelated, but they're each separate. They all have to do with the local parish. That doesn't sound very glamorous. One of the reasons I chose that is I don't think we're really spending much time looking at the local parish. Yet my greatest interest is what happens there, because that's where we walk. Holden is sort of mounting up with wings as eagles, if you like, Isaiah. And there are some other things where we run and don't get weary. The local parish is where we walk, and I'd like to be able to walk there without fingers. I'm more interested in what happens on Sunday morning when we get home than on some mountaintop experience here, even though I like this break. But it seems to me the long haul is week by week with all those ordinary people that we go home to, and with that red hymnal or whatever liturgy we might have. So all three are on the local parish. Today is sort of the background and the theology. Friday is more on the worship in the local parish, and Saturday is more on a quest for community, the kind of relationship that you could have in a parish. I will have to admit that the illustration is often the Community of Christ, because that's the parish I know best. But I'm not here to promote that form and call into question other forms. Now, to say that much, let me illustrate it. I have a son, Mark. He's here. He's 12 now. 7 when we moved into the District of Columbia, and I guess of all of our kids, he's the most urban. He likes it. Seems to thrive on it. But he had trouble with his bicycle. They kept disappearing. And this, I guess, really was his first kind of trauma when we moved in. Well, about 3 years and 4 bikes later, he had a bike, but it didn't have a seat on it. And he had been very patient. He had asked me for about 3 weeks if I could go to the bike shop with him. He came into my office, which is in our basement, about 10:30 in the morning, and I had a blank pad of paper with a pen just ready to start, and he said, "You're bigger." I said, "Yeah? What did you want?" He said, "Well, I thought maybe the bicycle seat." And I said, "That's what we're doing." And I dropped the pen, he got into the car, and we headed for the bike shop. He felt a little guilty, I guess. He said, "What were you going to do with that paper?" I said, "I was going to write a speech." He said, "When do you have to give it?" I said, "At 12 o'clock. Said, "What's the speech on?" And I said, "Toward a theology of urban ministry." And he said, "What does that mean?" Said, "I'm supposed to tell a group of men what the church ought to be doing in the city." We were about 2 blocks from our home in an area that's sort of hard to think of when you're up here, crowded, people out on the street. And he looked around at those people and he said, "The church ought to be helping these people." I said, "I guess that's about what my speech is going to say." He paused about 30 seconds and he said, "Don't those other guys know that?" I said, "I guess they do." Another 30 seconds, he said, "Well, I give the speech." I feel a little bit like that, talking about the local parish, the nature and the mission of the church, to people who already know it, or should, and therefore maybe the speech isn't even necessary. I do it because I guess all of us have to take a look once in a while at that which is the ordinary. And I think to give a talk about the nature and the mission of the church and to remind us of things we already know, maybe that's not too bad. Let's make it clear from the start that I have a basic premise about the local parish. I'm not ready to give it up. I'm not ready to give it up in the city until we try it. I don't think we've tried it yet. I do not hold for any single form that local group of people is going to take. I'm not happy with the local parish as it now is. We have 2 kinds of churches in Washington, D.C. We have suburban churches located in the suburbs, and we have suburban churches located downtown. Those are about the only kinds of churches we have right now. We bring in a kind of form which represents our Lutheran heritage, and we transplant that either rural or suburban church in the middle of the city, and we call it an urban church. And I don't exclude the community of Christ from that. I'm not sure we have yet found out what it means to be a group of people who celebrate Christianity in an urban secular setting. But I do think that it's worth talking about, and I'm glad to share it with you. I'm not ready to give up the parish. Joe Matthews was asked why he stayed within the church, and he said only a fool would give up a cigar box with a steeple on it at every crossroads in America, give up that kind of power base. He said, I stay in the church because I'm a revolutionary, and I'm not about to give up that kind of power base. So don't assume from what I said that I'm going to always maintain for the status quo. Historically, I think we've had some cycles in this century, and I think we're on the target with what we're going to be talking about for the next cycle. You may not argue with that, and I'll try to save much time for you to argue. We had a time of world missions. You could go onto a college campus with the dream of converting the world in one generation and get young people who would respond to that and go around the world. The era of world missions was a glorious one for the church. Then, sort of after that and phasing into that was the ecumenical movement, and we're still in that, still sort of superficial in that, still a place where we can congratulate ourselves that Roman Catholics and Lutherans are sitting down together, but at least we're into that era. Maybe Pope John the 23rd was the most important person in that in some ways, I don't know. We're also in, and still in, the whole era of the church getting involved in race, poverty, and war. And we haven't ended those problems by any means. I think the era we're entering is an era of theological reflection, especially constitutional analysis of the church. I don't mean looking at the bylaws and changing the number. I mean constitutional revision of the church. If we're stuck with a fundamentalism today, it's a morphological fundamentalism. It's a rigidity of the structures, and I think we really have to look at that. I have, the little antenna has gone up many times since Sunday noon. When I've heard that, which I guess I caustically call the old line, of the church is there and it converts individual people, and the individual people go out and they make a witness, and that's the way you change the world. I'm not attacking that politically or sociologically or from a power base right now. I'm attacking the premise of it, that you'll get those kinds of people from a self-preserving church. I don't think you will. I think if you have a structure called a parish that is turned in upon itself, that's the reality, that's the necessity I've got. Oh, I see that now. Now we have tall feet. If you have a parish turned in upon itself, existing for self-preservation, you will not produce people from that kind of nurturing who are turned out. You will produce people, the fruit of the tree will be similar to the tree. I think that if the medium is the message and you have a group of people who sit in pews looking at the back of other people's heads Sunday after Sunday, and the pulpit is up there 3 feet above criticism and you never speak back to it, that's the message. No matter what the man says, the message is already there in the architecture. The message is already there in the way in which that sermon is delivered. So I think that it's not wrong to talk about structure and assume that we're on something incidental to the gospel. Now let's get to some things that I put up as the title for today. If you talk about the parish and you talk about the future of it, it seems to me that there are at least three alternatives, and since they're somewhat rememberable and all begin with I use them. I think there are other ways you could say it. As you look ahead, and I'm referring only to those who have an interest in the church. I'm referring only to those who are loyal to it. Alternatives for that group. I've already made some selectivity. Those alternatives, each of which I think can be arrived at through genuine Christian conviction, are reform, renewal, and revolution. Let me just briefly say what I mean by that. By reform, The thing that's needed in the church is to make it more efficient, to inspire greater loyalty, to have greater commitment on the part of our people, to do what we're doing better, to be aware of stewardship, to take that which we have and clean it up in the best sense of the word. It was what Ignatius Loyola and the Jesuits did to the Roman Catholic Church. That was really reform. Luther's was much more, probably revolution. The Jesuits, from within, cleared up the immorality of the clergy and all kinds of other things, and that was genuine from the within reform. That's one alternative, and I think the one that's most popular. I guess it's 99% of the opinions here. I'm guessing that. Any administrator has to have this as his bag because he's called to be faithful to the present structure. And therefore, in order to be faithful and to be a good administrator, he has to constantly work at reform, and any other alternative comes as a threat, simply by the nature of the call which he knows and feels is the call upon his life by God. In reform, you would hope to get a few good guys in the bureaucracy. You would assume that changes come when you get some new thinking in the present division of American missions youth, or you have a long-range planning study and you come back to San Antonio in 1970 with a restructuring of the church, but it's reform. Let me jump. You're going to know already I'm building two straw men, so I can come down in the middle. Revolution. Revolution is really throwing out the present system. It is not speedy evolution at all. I'm assuming that there is no revolutionary here. I'm admitting that I can't be because I'm part of the present power structure in any way that anybody is, and so are you. And so revolution comes as a threat. It's a radical rejection, totally unacceptable. It makes the church as it presently exists an evil. We desire to eliminate it. In some ways, the underground church could be revolution, although others I don't think are. This is Darwin. He calls the thing he found in Denmark Christendom and puts that as the greatest evil of the Christian faith. That's sort of a revolutionary. A revolutionary would pray at the present day for a few deaths and a few fires. In between, and I don't think in this case the middle of the road is a cop-out. The middle of the road in this case is the hardest one to maintain, is renewal. That means a radical structural change, a totally reordering of priorities, a different stance and style for the church. And the reason that it's not easy is because every time you talk renewal, the revolutionaries are going to say you're only a reformer. And all of the reformers are going to call anything that's really radical renewal revolution and write you off. And that doesn't leave much space in between for you. If you like Kierkegaard, I kept thinking yesterday, if you like Kierkegaard, I think you'll be glad to step in with me into this, whatever it is, called renewal. Well, what would be involved? Let me try to say some of the theological premises that I think would be important if we talk about renewal. And I consciously picked some that are basic, and I consciously pick some words that are familiar, not as a way to try to end discussion by having a very difficult time arguing with crucifixion, which is one of the four I picked, but because I think that the basic renewal will be built on some basic theological premises. I picked four. I think you could pick some others. I picked creation, incarnation, crucifixion, and resurrection. Those are shorthand, those all can be broken open into all kinds of things. Let me just tell you why I picked those four and do it very briefly. Any renewal, I think, will start with creation. Dr. Joseph Stipler reminded the world of Lutheran some years ago that that's the doctrine we have really rejected, or at least minimized. I was once accused when someone heard I was a Lutheran of being, oh, you're a Unitarian of the second person of the Trinity. And many of the things we've written and many of the hymns in the red hymnal and many of the things we say sound as though we don't accept the doctrine of creation. We're just beginning, you know, the youth department of the ALC got into all kinds of trouble with a little book called To Be Human. Very interesting kind of reaction. I'm giving all the inside stories about American Lutherans. I'll have to get with some of the others so I can give some of their speech. I don't know those. I know on one occasion, a little magazine called Greater Works, which was from our brotherhood, had a hymn of love printed in it. And there was one local brotherhood in one part of the country who passed a resolution on the floor of the convention criticizing the American Lutheran Church for letting Greater Works have pornography in it. And one man there let it go all the way. It passed by a great vote. And he raised his hand and said, "I just want you to know what you just did." And they said, "What do you mean what we just did? You just censored as pornographic the Song of Solomon from the Old Testament. He just used Moffat's translation and he didn't know it." They did rescind the resolution. To be able to sing "This Is My Father's World" is a start. If you had a couple urban stanzas, it's a better hymn. There aren't any urban stanzas, and I'd like to be able to celebrate that that's our Father's world too. But to overcome the idea that in order to be a Christian you enter this world as an alien is not celebrating the creation. To have the dichotomies of sacred buildings because they have a cross on it and secular buildings because it says seats or coffee or bar or to carve out God's world in some kind of symbolic way instead of accepting "This is my Father's world." I think that the doctrine of creation will be a very important one if you're talking renewal, incarnation. But in this creation, we are called to be human. That when God expressed himself in the fullest way possible, it was in human form. That he chose to reveal himself, his word, the way he could speak to us, by becoming fully man. And I think in the history of theology, there have been many more controversies and many more heresies that deny his manhood than that could deny his saviorhood or his divine or his divinity or his lordship. I guess the first was Gnosticism. When you read in 1 John, you test the spirit by whether or not they affirm he came in the flesh. John goes to great lengths to say we touched him. I don't know if you know Martin Heineken or not. I'll have to test my audience with some like this, and then my wife will tell me whether I went too far. Martin Heineken said, "The farmer I talked to, he got down to it. He said, 'Do you mean he had balls?'" That's what you mean. Oh, I went too far. And to accept our humanity. The doctrine of the incarnation means that we accept ourselves in this creation as created human, and we don't continually try to reject that. We've had a lot of discussions about getting out of the flesh. Everywhere I've gone, these same things come up a little bit. Next is the doctrine of the crucifixion. We believe that it's God's world and that he has given us our life and that we do not have to reject who we are. In other words, to be a Christian is to take the one life we've been given and to grab it up and to fully live it, and then comes crucifixion when we are called to take that one life which we have, which we live fully, which we've grabbed and taken and extend it for the sake of the world's life. That's part of it too, if you're going to talk radical renewal. To take that which is our givenness and to lay it down for the sake of the world's life. But that's not a morbid thing. So my fourth theological premise, which I think will be important for radical renewal, is resurrection or eschatology. I guess either one. But that there is no grave deep enough, that there is no morbid kind of thing in that crucifixion that is not masochistic, that that's really the way to find life. A Roman priest and I were sitting on our back porch one night, and we had about four college students who were delighted to be able to try to pin us to the wall. When you have two crows, and they use that with a sneer, of two different denominations, then they were with great relish enjoying, and what they were doing was positing a mature secular humanist and a mature Christian, hoping to finally get us down to where we couldn't find any difference. And you know, many of the things we've said in the past aren't valid anymore. You can't say one's a good guy and one's a bad guy. You can't say one's moral and one's immoral. In fact, I don't think you can say one's selfish and one isn't selfish. Especially if you have a mature, altruistic humanist. And I think they felt they were about to come in for the kill, and whether it was the lateness of the hour or a couple bottles of beer or just panic, I came up with something that was not thought through, and I said that ultimately the difference will be the Christian will have a better sense of humor. And we went on that for a while. Not only did they buy it, but it was better than I thought it was when I said it. And Luther, when they take good, sane child, wife, when they their works have done, they yet have nothing won but kingdom hours remaineth. That's the given eschatological sense of humor. That's not a shallow thing at all. Ultimately, the Christian is differentiated by that kind of sense of humor of not taking himself or any of his causes too seriously. That's going to be important for radical renewal. All right. Those are some of the theological points. What's involved then, what does this kind of thing lead to? It leads to the present church being turned inside out, in Heckendijk's phrase, H-O-E-K-E-N-D-I-J-K. Get by his name and find his book, and it's very good. Especially the chapter when he says there's now a fourth man. And my only argument was he didn't tell me who the third man was. I guess he assumes we all knew that, but there is a fourth man. It's a fascinating chapter. It's a church inside out, a church that exists for self-expenditure instead of self-preservation. Now that's radical renewal. As soon as I begin to implement that, you're going to begin to say, revolution. Let me illustrate this for you in my own life. There's a trap when you start a parish. I started a parish in Annandale, Virginia, and it was a package mission. I had no pressure from my regional director to succeed. The trap was of my own doing and of the church's structure, not of any one person. Here's the trap. In order for the church to be engaged in mission, you have to have some people. You have to have some missionaries. The first job, therefore, is to gather together this group of people. That's right. That's better than me trying to do it all by myself. So the first step is to get a group of people together. In order for them to be equipped, you need a place of some kind. It sounds sensible. So we built a package mission structure. That was a place for these people to worship, to receive the sacraments, to be educated, to have some classrooms, for the whole thing to be administered, so I had an office. That's the next step. This was a place where people were equipped for ministry. In order to have ministry, you have to have ministers, and you have to have trained ministers. Now, the fact is, when the choice between ministering, and at that point, it was probably the civil rights movement in Northern Virginia, or something else, it could have come. The trap came when the choice between ministry and preserving this place where we were going to equip ministers came, we chose self-preservation. When a congregation is more concerned about the window that's broken than the kid who broke it, you know the trap sprung some time ago. I gave a talk after being in the Community of Christ for 1 year. We had had, I think at that point, we had 11 people. And I described to some seminarians what we had done for a year. It was really not very much. And their answer was, couldn't another church have done that? And my answer was, any existing church in the District of Columbia could have done what we did. They could have done more than we've done. They all have at least 10 times as many people. They all have a bigger budget, and they all have a facility in which to do it. We didn't have any building at all. They all could have done what I've described and more. I'm not sure they would have. Duke Lundeen,
LCA pastor of one of the churches, it is a pretty good one, said, I want to add to what John said. Not only we may not have done it, we didn't do it, we won't do it, and we won't do it next year. Now, I didn't say that, but he did. That the trap had sprung on self-preservation, and there was a group of people called a Lutheran church, and the pastor knew full well that most of the time and the effort went into preserving that which they had. When they got people, it was because they had the money to keep the thing going. That's the trap. That's the primary thing, I think, that has to be broken if you're talking radical renewal. Gordon Cosby at the Church of the Savior has it in a dance step, and I don't know the dance, but in the dance step there is a moving foot and there is a standing foot. In other words, in order to do the dance, you have to keep one foot firm and the other can move around. And he says church renewal means to shift that weight completely. The plantedness of the church is not its institutional, its bureaucratic, or even its organizational function that can't be moved, and you experiment with ministry. The planted foot is in the servanthood and the involvement in the world's life, in liberation. The planted foot is among the oppressed people where Christ is. The moving foot are the forms and the structures and the constitutions and the liturgies and the vestments and all of the other things. Those can all be changed easily. Christ never planted any of those. You can mess around out there. The planted foot is in Christ's involvement in the issues of the world's life. That's going to be revolution when you implement that. But I think that's on that fine line called radical renewal. In other words, there's a false premise that somehow we thought God said we had to save the church. We had to preserve the church. That's when I said this one time, a man quoted scripture at me and said, Christ promised that the gates of hell would not prevail against us. That's the strangest kind of use of that scripture. It seems to me that the gates of hell protect hell. It's not an offensive weapon that hell has. What Christ promised was, if you're on the move, you'll barge right down through the gates of hell. He never promised that somehow these gates wouldn't get up and move and come and squash your church. If we say that the essence of the Christian life is self-expenditure, you will not get people who understand that, and that's a totally different way of looking at power and success and victory. It's really a very radical thing. I wish there was a way that we could, in each generation, let the gospel be as radical as it is. For Luther, it came sort of through justification by faith, and it was a radical kind of thing. I wish there was a way that that could be fresh and new. But if that's the gospel, then a church has to have the same abandonment about its own corporate life and just trust that God does not need any particular form of the church or anything else, that you can lose your life institutionally, corporately, in order to find it, that something else better will be created. I guess that's probably the reason why I really don't know how we can sometimes call a man into certain kinds of administrative duties and not know that it continues to, in some way, go against the grain of the very essence of the gospel. But maybe that's where some of the discussion is. The excitement for me, and I do not think we're in a new age of the social gospel. The trouble with the social gospel, historically, is not that it was social, but that it wasn't the gospel. Dave Lukey has a good article on that. I forget where he wrote it, but I think we're in an age where we understand the difference between the social gospel, Rauschenbusch and others, and today is today does have a theological, liturgical basis to it. The thing that we're in today, which is exciting to me, is that it's in the midst of the involvement and the action that the theology is written. And I think that's where it should be written. The theology in this era now of theological reflection, which I said I thought we were moving into, of constitutional evaluation and analysis, meaning what is a parish, what is a church. The excitement is that the layman will write the theology. They'll have to. Some theologian in a seminary will put it down in writing. I don't mean that the layman will write the book, but all the cues will come from the people who are involved in the world's life, not from a classroom or from a tower. I think that's one of the exciting things about it, that it's in the midst of joining with God in His redeeming work that you understand the nature and the mission of the church, and I think that's what we're going to find more and more. To say that we're finding that more in D.C. now than somewhere else, I'm not sure that's true. All I can tell you is that it's different enough than some of the areas you come from that perhaps the dialogue is helpful. Our area has 40,000 people in a square mile. That's, again, sort of hard to remember out here, which is one of the nice things about getting a break from there. And maybe 5% of those people bear some kind of Christian affiliation. You carve the Lutherans out of that, which is 0.7% within the District of Columbia. And if I would gather them together and say, "Dearly beloved," they would think I had just proposed to them. It would be an intimate little group. That kind of secular setting in the city may be part of that which confronts us. But anyway, I think that radical renewal is exciting because I think it is the gospel, and I think it is that to which we're called for this age. What kinds of things does that call into question? Because I want to get into what kind of worship will lead from that and what kind of community will lead from that at other days. But the kinds of things that it calls into question, I think it calls into question property, church buildings, whether we own anything, whether we pay taxes on what we do own. I think it calls into question ordination. I think it calls into question whether or not a group of people select from their midst someone in ordaining, or whether they get sent someone from up above. I think it calls into question denominationalism. I think it calls into question whether the church can have any kept women who have their salaries coming from the church, or whether pastors ought to work like other men do. I think it calls into question all kinds of things for which, any lecturer sounds more arrogant because he has some prepared notes that you get at him in the question period and find out he doesn't have any more answers than you do. I do not feel that the church has the answers to these. I just think it's an exciting time to be in the questioning period. I wanted to take you 25 minutes, I guess, but I gave you 20.
John,
before
we have a question, do you have a vision of what you're going to talk about Friday and Saturday?
All right. Okay. The kind of theology, the church is formed by the Word and the world, by the givenness of the gospel and the present situation in which we find ourselves. Seems to me the theology we're talking about now calls for a radical renewal, basically in turning the church inside out so it exists for self-expenditure, so it exists for the sake of the world's life, not its life. And that has some tremendous effect upon the way it relates itself to one another or operates. Friday, I want to take what does this basic premise do about worship? What does it mean when this group of people who have gathered together around the gospel understood this way when they worship? How do they do it? What do they do? What are they trying to say when they do it? Is the church a filling station and you come there and you get refueled? That's been used here a couple times. Or is that really very dangerous? Do they come and get 1 hour of God's fresh air and hold their breath through a godless existence during the week till they can get back to the sanctuary? Does that follow? Or is that real heresy? Then on Saturday, what kind of interrelations will they have? Can they be a community? Diversity and individuality, secular setting and a monastic ideal, of living together, of a holding in the midst of DuPont Circle. You just have to find the form which will be much more the constitutional revision itself. What might a parish look like? That will be more satisfying.
Okay.
So
what do you mean by the
world
like an hour like these that are set before the time? Because of the people's history, so you think about
the world
like
an hour
like
the
world's life?
Yeah. Well, I guess I understand the gospel much in a much more public, corporate way than private, individual way, first of all, and I had trouble with some of the discussion the other day. Maybe one of the ways to answer is that God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that if we could change our diagram of God to and through the church to the world, and make the diagram God to the world, and in the midst of that world, that group that discerns or recognizes his work is the called out ecclesia, church, that God's activity was and is making whole, taking that which was broken and reconciling or making us whole, and therefore the church exists to participate in that activity, not to ensure for itself its own safety, success, or anything else, but to participate in that freeing the oppressor, liberating, healing, forgiving, reconciling. In other words, the church is called to extend itself in God's activity, which is still making this world whole. Is that right? Okay. I guess I'd have to ask you first to specify. If you're asking whether or not I think the church will be renewed along the lines that I outlined, the hopes or possibilities for that, or Vern's question, to what extent will we be successful in the reconciling, saving, healing ministry? Well, you see, the burden is off us because it's God's activity and we participate in it. So depends upon your vision of whether or not that day is coming in 500 years or 30 years or 3,000 years or when his redeeming activity will be complete. So I'm not sure I understand your question. We will achieve a perfect society. Probably not. I don't have any argument with any of the language of Scripture about the last days or anything else. I just want to participate in that which I think is God's activity today. I'm not sure there'll be any perfect social structure. I don't see any utopia, but I don't think that, the poor you shall have with you always. We have a Lutheran congressman who always uses that against the new food stamp program. Well, that wasn't a new commandment to the Christians. That was a statement of the fact that God knew we'd have Joel Broyhill as a congressman. But it's probably true. The poor you'll have with you always. That I envision that if we all got behind it, we would create the perfect society here. No. Somebody else has it.
Yeah. I guess I'd even go one step stronger than that. I feel that kind of a statement of unbelief to the extent that, what John just said, the hook, we're off the hook. Now it's God's thing. And that really means that from my perspective, God can do His thing, and that's really neat, whatever it is. You know, and I just like to be around to point at it.
You and I agree 100% on what the foundation is. We disagree, perhaps, and if we do, let's say that we do. Dialogue is what this place is all about. We do disagree, perhaps, on where that living Lord is and where you join Him. What I'm saying is that, if I understood Gordon Crosby, that the stationary foot, meaning the foot that's grounded in Jesus Christ, will be in the involvement in God's activity of redeeming, liberating, all of that, not in that which all of us are more accustomed to thinking about as the place where we find Jesus. Now that I think we probably disagree on, and it's a good discussion. This, I come to the garden alone, I think is heresy, if you mean you can think in terms of finding Jesus more in the privacy of your room and when you have your Bible open and in the times called prayer and in the formality of a worship service, and it's very hard to consider finding Jesus in the midst of the present turmoil of the only place where in the history of God's redeeming activity, you can be pretty certain that He's there in the midst of that. That's where the church is. Now, all of those other things are means to the end of the church as mission or ministry, and so they're important, but they can be changed in order to implement the task and the purpose of the church, and that's ministry in God's world. That can't be tampered with, and you tend to call that which I think is the essence of the gospel social action projects which can or cannot be done, and I don't buy that. I don't.
Well, it could be that the oppression that is the oppression of my own individual gift, and not the oppression of somebody behind me, or somebody who is not at one particular moment receiving justice, but it is my own gift.
Right. And I think you find life, including forgiveness, including that which washes away that guilt, by losing your life. And that is, my understanding of that is by engaging with God in His mission activity, not sitting and somehow going through the spiritual exercises of getting that forgiven. In other words, He has a way in which you participate and become free, and it's participating in that which is the standing foot, which is the foundation of Jesus Christ, which is the involvement in the world's life. That's
I feel that when I lose my life, as you just mentioned,
not depending on my own work or my own effort.
Right. That's right.
But it seems to tell you say, it is my work and my effort for the time of somebody else.
Oh, okay. If I said that, I didn't mean that. Or if you heard that, that's not at all what I meant. The one doctrine that I think is the greatest Reformation doctrine is grace alone. That's the essence of being a Christian is to live by grace. What I'm saying is that does not mean that the Christian is 47% more spiritual than someone else or anything else. It means he lives by grace. And that the epitome of that is to be free to lose yourself in God's activity. And I don't, immediately we have social action projects come up. And that's one part of what I think happens when someone is converted. You know, to be converted means to be turned around, and that's a revolution. I don't think, maybe we do disagree, but I don't think we do on that last point. Will?
John, do I detect some theological tiptoeing in your teaching of eschatology? I think I hear what you're saying. It sounds as if you might be calling into question the traditional Lutheran understanding of it, which may be compared to waiting for the eschaton by keeping your nose in a mailbox. And expecting to come in the form of either a brown manila envelope or a special delivery letter. I'd just like to hear you deal with that, because I think the discussion somehow, sort of leads us into that arena, and you have to treat it a little more, at least for
now. I'm not sure I'm theologian enough. At least I know I couldn't read Moltmann. I tried. So I'm not sure that I'm tiptoeing. I'm just not sure. I don't think Lutheran theology ever had, for me, the delivered brown manila envelope. If I understood what I believed before, it was realized eschatology. I got that much from Moltmann and Tannenberg and the rest of them. So I think you'd have to come back at me again and talk, just talk, not theological language. I didn't find any exception. I don't find any exception to what you said, but I wasn't trying to dodge it for the sake of anyone's feelings or for the sake of maybe it's heretically un-Lutheran or something. Is that?
Yeah. Well, you're familiar with this.
Yeah?
The most corrupting influence among churches that we assess is their adoption of the lie that Christianity is primarily concerned with an otherworldly reality. Missionaries persuaded most black religious people that life on earth was insignificant because obedient servants of God could expect a reward in heaven after death, as one might expect obedience meant adherence to the laws and, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then the end of the black spirit go, "Oh Lord, when I die, I want to go to heaven, my Lord, when I die."
The reason that I don't think I was tiptoeing is I tried to say that pretty strongly on creation and incarnation. I was never taught in our seminary, there'll be pie in the sky by and by, and I remember the dean of our seminary saying, "Many of you came here not understanding that the promise of the New Testament is a new heaven and a new earth. And that's your destiny of the earth. You were never created to be a sexless spiritual creature floating around in heaven. You're a man, and the promise is for a new earth, and you'll be a man." Yeah, that was one of the highlights from our dean. He had some other things I couldn't buy. I thought he was pretty good on that.
That understanding of eschatology then demands radically very good.
One of the problems with the story of church made a sense to it. And the reason is, and some of them I like the words, but I for one would like to hear the vendor what the church is doing and has done. And one of the problems with the church is it has no PR. And unfortunately, I don't have no PR, no public relations. So I learned people today. But not right now.
I'm not sure that I have any answer to that other than affirming what you said. I started by saying I'm going to talk about the parish, strongly committed to the local parish, that I'm a loyal critic of much of what's there, but a very loyal person to the idea of the church. I'm very critical of the clergymen who go where the action is, which means $15,000 a year in some government bureaucracy, and think that's where the action is instead of the local parish. I think it's a cop-out. Pardon? I said I'm very critical of the guy who says, I'm going to go where the action is, which means he gets some GS-14 in HUD instead of working with a group of people called a parish. I don't think the action is the paper shuffling of the government bureaucracy. What I'm saying is, I think the most disloyal thing would be to try to PR the present church as though it needed no change. Yeah, right. And probably for the sake of discussion, I have talked about turning the church inside out, meaning a reordering of priorities, but if I didn't have hopes in it, I'd be a revolutionary. See, the renewal means you take what you have, and Joe Matthews was a little caustic, saying the only reason he's still in is because there's that cigar box with his people on it every time. He also said, I'm in it because that's where I found my Lord, in that church. And that church has mothered me in the right sense, you know? And it's in that ordinary parish, however it finds its new life, it's in that ordinary parish among people with whom you live and commune and pray and share and everything else that I think the essence of Christianity is to be found, sacramentally. Now, yeah, I didn't talk about existing parishes and what they're doing that I think are very significant. There are many things. That's why I still have hope. Yeah. I had an urban specialist come to me, very critical of the church, and just wrote the whole thing off. And he was an expert on urban problems. And I took it for about 5 minutes, and I said, where do you live? And he told me where he lived. It was a high-rise apartment out of any urban problems at all. And I said, when you come, and when you live where Gino Baroni, who's a Roman Catholic priest, when you live where he lives and live the kind of life he lives, then you can come back to me and talk about the urban problem. Don't write the church off until the urban experts are down in the dirt where basically Christian people are in the midst of the city. Now, there's a lot of others whom I respect very much who are also there, but this guy wasn't. And the church is there. And I'm very glad that it is. It still gets its hands dirty. And I'm not writing that off. That's why I'm so interested in the parish. Her.
I'd like you to put that two pictures that I would open up my parish again. And I like it very much. The idea of even though I'm going to be able to find something like that, and the reason for that is it's wrong. Just like the brother of the Bible. I like the idea of eschatology being tied up with humans. And I guess the second stage, so you got a whole thing going for me. Philosophy. I don't even feel it's called what heaven can look like. Or that, but the curiosity for today and its height and the fun of life and peace. If that link with something like eschatology, which is always the last thing, the last chapter, the last God, is for me an exciting idea. I'm glad for that. never took me a human life for me, and I like it very much. It was the friends that I think it's because I always wanted to dance. If I could be graduate with, I would want to learn how to go over dance with you. And put my money straight, and this kind of motion, I mean, it's about one foot standing still and suffering the other one down, and this happened. I'd like to see the guy who can do it, because I can't do that. And yet that face look is marvelous, isn't it? I think sometimes, John, I would try the other way around, and sort of get the liturgical foot standing still, and try and move the other one around. And it works both ways. One of the things that I would hear once in a while is that you've got to turn down. Instead of saying, and why did I say something, I could really try it on for a couple of days and work it the other way around. And so I'm glad for that piece. One foot standing still. And I think you could say that the foot is planted. There's Christ involved, you know, in the word. There's quite a Christological. Now, I think the Christ involvement in the world is at the kind of foot. I guess you get stuck with it, but I'm going to try it on another foot, the one that stumbles around.
What about the
social action or bring a particular group of people to be oppressed, but I can do fully involved. It doesn't mean I'm aloof from it or that I'm waiting for heaven to come. In fact, I think I can be involved uniquely with a song because of grace, and I'm sort of free from the obligation that my life is dependent upon this activity or project, and I think that's a God-given nonchalance. That's part of what I meant by humor. Now, all right, I don't think that you necessarily can say someone has a particular experience before he can live that way, or that someone tries it and then knows it. I think it comes all kinds of ways, and you continue to rediscover it. And I'm not arguing with what Lutheran just said is the work of the Holy Spirit in conversion or any of those other things. I just think we have too limited a way of re-confined into the means of grace as we understood them, instead of assuming that it breaks through sometimes when someone got involved in a thing like that.
Well, we use the term in order to my question regarding the means of grace.
Well, I guess I wouldn't limit it to word and sacrament, but I wouldn't deny word and sacrament as means of grace. I'll limit it to means of grace being word and sacrament, but I have a different definition of word.
I think I can sacrament, but I think I didn't want to say that word and sacrament come through, well, the word, the great word, the gracious word is heard also by some people who aren't
But they may have experienced it, and you help them recognize it. I don't want grace to be a commodity that you don't have, that I do, and I can give you a little. You have it, but the care of evangelism is to share the discernment of that, wherever you have experienced it, and then new histories of new experiences of that kind. But the point at which verbally you help them discern that, I think that's still very much part of the ministry of the church. And sacramentally, bread and wine, it isn't a separate eating and drinking, separated from all other eating and drinking. It is a way in which we discern sacramentally that all eating and drinking are to a certain extent sacraments of God. That's a new vista that I think fits well. And I don't think it denies the validity of the sacrament, bread and wine, Eucharistically. One day is holy and 6 days are profane. One day is set aside so we know that all of life and all of time has a sacred dimension. You set aside a time for prayer, not that all of life can't be a prayer, but if none of life is a disciplined kind of prayer, then I don't think any of life is. You need the set apartness, the sacramental, the symbolic, in order to begin to understand new vistas. And so they're not unimportant, they're very important, but you don't then compartmentalize them and call that your religious life. You know, that opens up all of life.
I'm going to answer my question better if I try to. Although I like to be